You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can also find us on iTunes, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. After the election of Trump as Pot USA, cities around the U.S. have seen huge protests. Portland, Oregon, in particular, has seen over a week of intense protracted street action in which people faced off with police and reactionaries in the street. As such, there have been many arrests, and there are some facing felony charges. There's a request for assistance in fundraising for arrest support. Please consider raising some funds and donating to Portland Anarchist Black Cross's GoFundMe, www.gofundme.com/support-fund-anti-Trump-activists.
This week on the show, we spoke with two members of the anarchist community here in Asheville, May and Julie, about current events and this idea of a general strike and how to go from here, and also some ideas on how to engage with current events right now. I should mention that this conversation was originally about an hour and a half long. We had to cut it down to about 51 or 52 minutes. I highly encourage people to download the podcast version, which will be available via iTunes. There is a lot of other stuff in there. If people are interested in this conversation, please feel free to go ahead and do that. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a bomb! I'd like to share with you a recent event here at Warren Corruptional that just might demonstrate in full living color just how mentally ill these wackadoodle fascists are. This event involves three prisoners, Collins, Rammel, and Raypole, one of whom lived in the honor block, and two of whom had received a security decrease at the time that this happened, and they were only waiting to transfer to lower security. Now Collins, Rammel, and Raypole are the women's bathroom three. So here's what happened. On October 5th, the three prisoners had visits. Their female visitors all used the bathroom. While in the bathroom, their visitors put things in the trash. That's it. What they didn't know is that the prison investigator, Marty Jones, had placed a hidden camera in the women's bathroom. Jones, whose nickname is Bow Chicka Wow Wow, reminiscent of the guitar lick and the porno background music, claims he was granted permission to install a camera in the women's bathroom. Of course, what investigator Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones doesn't mention is that he got permission to install the hidden camera in the visiting room in the women's bathroom from the captain of his bowling team. That permission notwithstanding, Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones didn't bother asking a judge, as the law requires, and he didn't turn over the footage to the judge before viewing it, as the law requires. That means Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones committed a felony by watching women use the bathroom in Warren Correctional's visitation. According to the conduct reports issued against the three prisoners, their visitors were observed placing what he terms packages into the trash can. Of course, Bow Chicka Wow Wow didn't view the video until the following day, so he didn't recover whatever was put into the trash, so he has no clue what it was. But that didn't stop him from concluding that it wasn't used maxi pads, but was instead.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
But was, instead, drugs. Bow Chicka Wow Wow doesn't reveal how he can conclude that packages he didn't recover are drugs, and he doesn't describe how the three male prisoners plan to get the packages of drugs out of the trash in the women's bathroom. By the conduct reports, the three prisoners did nothing at all. While accused of attempting to procure drugs, there's no description of any conduct at all, indicating that Collins, Rammel, or Raypole broke any rules in any way. They went to a visit, sat through the visitation, and then went back to their cells. Now, because the three female visitors used the bathroom and used the trash, those visitors are suspended. Further, all three prisoners were railroaded through the Rules Infraction Board where the total and absolute absence of any evidence never stopped Lieutenant Nelson from finding prisoners guilty. The two who were slated for lower security are now stuck here for at least another year, and all three are housed in the sanctions block, where privileges are greatly curbed. All of this, not to beat a dead horse here, without recovering whatever went into the trash, and without any idea where it went, and without any theory as to how the three prisoners intended to get the unknown items from the trash. But I think the most disturbing thing about all of this is the creepo fascists who run Ohio's prisons have given themselves permission to put hidden cameras in the women's bathroom, contrary to existing laws, and on the basis of some ridiculous pretext that anything tossed into a trash can is drugs. So on this pretext, how many female visitors have been secretly recorded on video using the bathroom? If female visitors coming to see me use the bathroom and place trash in the trash can, which is where it goes, is Bowchicka Wow Wow Jones going to decide they are drug pushers and exile them for life? We're talking about fascists who have decided that using the mail makes you a gang member, telling the truth on the radio makes you a terrorist, and civilians using the trash in the bathroom makes them drug pushers. I think this signals their absolute irrationality, their complete lack of regard for the harm they inflict on people, on human beings struggling along under their oppression. There's no reforming a system that's under the mismanagement of the Bowchicka Wow Wows of the world. The only answer is to topple the entire machine by any means necessary. Let's make September 9th a reality every single day of the year. Free the Women's Bathroom 3 and fire Bowchicka Wow Wow Jones. You can call Warden's assistant, Gestapo Greg Kraft, at 513-932-3388, extension 2010. That's 513-932-3388, extension 2010, and express your rage. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205. Warren C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. Thank you both so much for coming to the studio and talking with me about this stuff at this time.
Thanks for having us.
Sure thing. Would you mind introducing yourselves and talking a little bit about what y'all do?
Well, my name is Julie, and I guess what I do. Well, in terms of the kind of anarchist-affiliated work that I'm involved in Asheville, I work with the Prison Books Project. I'm a member of the Firestorm Collective and recently doing a fair bit of work around prison and prisoner solidarity, which kind of kicked off with the September 9th prison strike, but is ongoing. And right now looks like putting together an ongoing bail fund, and that's in the works. So it's a major project. And then, of course, just trying to figure out what a comprehensive community response to the election of Donald Trump is going to look like.
My name is May. I'm part of the Firestorm Collective that operates Firestorm Books and Coffee.
Who underwrites this show?
Oh!
Yeah. It's a conflict of interest.
Well, gosh darn it. So that takes up a lot of my time, and I kind of participate, try to organize small projects here and there when I can. Mostly I just post on social media a lot.
Julie, do you feel like talking about the article that you wrote at all?
Sure. So I wrote an article actually a number of weeks before the election, although ultimately I didn't end up posting it up online on Medium until a few days before the election. And it was called, the title is Trump is What Democracy Looks Like, which is kind of like a dig at some of the like activist rhetoric and chant protest chant language, because as an anarchist, like, I have a critique of democracy. So it was kind of a dig at that. And basically the gist of the article was to point out kind of the inherent contradictions and limitations of democratic political doctrine, which are always present, but I think in this particular election cycle were, like, really prominent and perhaps more obvious to people who aren't even necessarily anti-statist, because you had kind of maybe first time in all of American politics, but certainly in very recent history, openly authoritarian rhetoric. We've definitely had, like, racist rhetoric and misogynist rhetoric and homophobic and transphobic and classist rhetoric pretty consistently, usually more toned down, more coded, but that's been pretty consistent. But the authoritarian streak was something that felt new. And because authoritarianism is seen to be, like, in direct counterpoint to democracy, it was really interesting to see, like, a candidate progressing through, not until after the article was posted, did we even know that it was going to be to the end, but, you know, progressing through, who was espousing that ideology, and actually that not really seeming to bother people. and the people who it was bothering were people who I would consider, like, Democrats or progressives or liberals. And it seemed interesting to me that the very people who he would alienate the most with that kind of rhetoric, it was their adherence to those democratic ideals that would actually ultimately prevent them from speaking out against him if he actually did become the president. Yeah. Which, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this in the rest of the interview, that ultimately is what we've seen happen, is a lot of complacency, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was the thrust of it. And the reason why I wrote it was to point those things out, but also just because I was concerned that I really didn't hear anyone giving any credence whatsoever to the fact that he could actually win. Mm-hmm. Like, it was constantly brought up as a fear tactic in order to get people to vote for Clinton. But then it didn't seem like anyone was creating any kind of mobilization plan if he did win, or any kind of plan B, contingency, whatever. And that was concerning to me from a practical standpoint, because I felt like, what if this guy gets elected and we're not ready? But also, again, from, like, a theoretical standpoint of why aren't people engaging with what that is going to mean for them and the choices they're going to make in the face of a legitimately elected authoritarian demagogue. So I kind of concluded that the reason that people weren't doing that thinking into the future was because they simply did not want to actually confront those contradictions. It was more comfortable to actually put themselves and the people in the country in danger of being governed by someone like this. It was more comfortable to have that potential than to confront the internal contradictions of democracy. So it really wasn't even necessarily to galvanize people after the election, because I wasn't even thinking it was going to go that way. But I have gotten a lot of feedback. I was hoping that even if that was the case, people would still, it would kind of give people a moment of pause about, like, reflecting on their own, you know, kind of ideology and where that might bring them/us. So the feedback that I have gotten once the election did happen was that it was, you know, kind of freakishly, like, prescient and kind of creeping people out. So I haven't honestly gotten much, like, critical feedback in the sense of the kind that I would want, which would be, like, poking at or pulling at some of my ideas and being like, hey, but did you think about this? You know, it'd be nice to have more of a dialogue around it, honestly, but I haven't. This is the part about being bad with social media, is, like, you throw something up online and then you're like, I'm not going to look at what people say or anything. It's interesting. I wrote it for Democrats, but I want to hear feedback from anarchists.
So we are here to talk about what seems to be on everybody's minds right now. Maybe some people feel really talked out about it, but I think that there's a lot of room for speculation and, like, analysis. And there has been, like I said before, that from a lot of different perspectives. I was wondering if y'all would talk about your initial reactions to this election and also talk a little bit about how you were feeling about it or how you're thinking about it almost 2 weeks after the fact, given kind of the immense amount of action that has happened, also the immense amount of internal and external struggle that has happened with it, vis-a-vis like social media and in real life. I was wondering if y'all would talk about that some.
Yeah, I was not surprised. I know a lot of people were surprised, and there have been mainly, I guess, probably in tucked away in academia, which is unfortunate, but articles about the resurgence of fascism in the United States, and elsewhere too, and particularly the similarities between the United States under the current administration and the Weimar Republic, that like the conditions were such that like someone like Hitler coming to power was a feasible reality. So I wasn't surprised, but I was disappointed, and I was more disappointed, and not at like Trump winning or Clinton losing, but at the very predictable mass response where people that had been saying, like, we can't work with this guy, he's literally Hitler, or like, he's a misogynist and this is unacceptable, like, how can this person be president, are suddenly like, oh, maybe it's not so bad, like, no big deal. And, or like, you know, saying that, like, we have to give him a chance and we have to work with him. And there's actually there's a New York Times article from 1922 where they wrote, several reliable, well-informed sources confirmed the idea that Hitler's anti-Semitism was not so genuine or violent as it sounded.
Oh, no.
And there was some elsewhere where, and it was in one of the local Facebook groups, people were talking about how we needed to mobilize because we, like, this is kind of horrifying. And someone said that they weren't going to get too paranoid because there weren't whatever death camps and stuff. I don't know what you think, prisons and deportation centers are, but that's fine. And if there were to be an American Kristallnacht, that would be the time to get out into the streets. And there were five years of like anti-Semitic legislation leading up to Kristallnacht. And that was before the outbreak of World War II even. So I'm mostly just like furious at people who have like constantly like, we have to learn from history, like not let history repeat itself. There's a Holocaust museum in Washington, D.C., and suddenly this is fine. Anyone that's ever said that they would go back in time and shoot baby Hitler and are saying that they're going to work with Donald Trump now is a hypocrite.
Maybe never again means like maybe in 60 years. We have to listen to their voices. We can't forget about them. They're ignored. They're forgotten.
Yeah, and like how like rhetoric has devolved in some circles to like peace policy kind of talk and stuff like that, and like, you know, as a way to like denigrate militant tactics and to be like, oh no, we just need to have love. We need to have like a unity rally. We need to have love Trump's hate, which I hate that chant, by the way. It's a really poor play on words, and anyone who's listening to this should consider just not using it at all, in my opinion.
I think I would just add to that I think there is also this aspect of American exceptionalism that is part and parcel of like all of our issues mobilizing and the roadblocks that get thrown up by kind of like progressives and liberals who want to critique the system but don't want to fundamentally question why that system is the way it is in the first place, and really just don't have an analysis of power. And so there is this sense, I think, that it's just like people can't conceive, even though everything that May just said is like completely spot on, people don't think it can happen here, even though, again, like you said, it's already happening here.
On a personal level, it's like very, it's been very anxiety-inducing because my families not from the United States. And on the one hand, like, I don't have an accent and stuff, but my parents do. And I feel like historically when there's like this level of like threat, that the circles of who is impacted spread wider and wider. I don't know, just driving down the street, I'm like, is that cop now going to be extra empowered to hurt or kill somebody? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I just don't know. And that's horrifying. And I like, suicide rates have gone up, calls to crisis lines have gone up. And the fact that that's kind of being ignored, like, why, like, love and unity needs to be with those people that are like hurting and scared, because they're going to be impacted on some level. I mean, that includes us for sure. And not the oppressor. That's very upsetting. And then I see a lot of people that don't know what to do and are like, well, we better organize for midterm elections, or like, mm-hmm. well, in four years from now. And I'm like, that is how you got here. Like, why is it so hard to imagine anything other than waiting to elect somebody else to be in charge of whether or not you're going to live or die?
What do y'all think about the anarchist response so far?
Well, we're just getting started, so I'm not really sure I have I can really like reflect on kind of like the strategic usefulness or whatnot of what we're doing. I think we're getting started in a good direction.
We do have so many anarchist organizing. Isn't that a contradiction? Jokes to look forward to. So there's that. I'm a little bit, it feels a little bit overwhelming, because it feels like anarchists that I know are the only ones that are responding. I mean, not exclusively, definitely, but anarchists and maybe other political radicals are the only folks responding in ways that seem to be like they might be effective in the long term. So I guess that's good, but I feel like very unprepared. I think other people feel very unprepared. And there's also some, not sure if I can speak for anyone else, but kind of a sense of panic that like hasn't been mobilization, that we've just been like, I don't know.
What do you think it would take to like feel prepared for this, or like to be prepared for this?
I think that there's a lot of issues kind of internal to like various communities that I'm aware of, and the fact that it's been such a struggle to address racism and misogyny and kind of like class elitism within like the radical left is really hard, because I'm still like seeing people saying more eruditely worded, but along the same lines of like, no war but class war. And it's like, no, that's not how it f-ing works. Like, sorry, class war. I mean, I'm for it, just not exclusively.
Yeah.
So that feels really hard. And also just not having the same strength in numbers and militancy as I've seen in like anarchist responses to crises in Europe, which like, again, still really challenging, but it just feels a lot like there's greater numbers and greater like solidarity, like real solidarity. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and a less precarious, well, I mean, I can't speak to other people's existences, but in terms of like a wider base to draw from, American people and workers are in such a precarious position in so many ways that really discourages, I think, building a movement. And so, I mean, one of the questions you asked was about the anarchist organizing. And one of the things that, you know, I've heard and gotten excited about was this idea of a general strike. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited about seeing where it goes. But at the same time, I have felt kind of hopeless about it, because I know that the conversations I have with people who aren't necessarily already, like, politicized, people are going to look at me like I have three heads. Like, yeah, I don't like Donald Trump, but what does my job have to do with it?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for folks who maybe have a more robust political history to draw from and a, like, present culture, like, political culture, which I think does exist perhaps more strongly in Europe, the link between the way that power is, like, a thread that runs through, like, politics to workplaces to social relationships is more apparent to people. So I've been thinking a lot about how to try to explain to people why, you know, why a strike tactic would be relevant to protesting a political administration.
Yeah.
And even for me, it's like a little like, okay, wait, why? You know, I have to think about it. But I also feel strongly that, and basically it's like the ability to disrupt,
yeah.
You know, it's where you show that you have power. So that's one tactic.
And it's like a tool we have, like the tool of refusal, I think is a pretty potent one, or it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So right after my thing about liberals that I said earlier, I would I have that question about liberals that I sent to y'all, which was, in any situation like this, what seems to come up pretty frequently for anarchists is engagement with, quote, liberals or toxic liberals, perhaps, trying to inject messages of hope and love, which pretty much, like, from an anarchist or from my anarchist perspective, I guess, pretty much only serves to dilute and mischaracterize anarchist strategy. What is your opinion on engagement with liberals? Is ignoring them a useful tactic in your opinion? And is there any room for useful engagement with folks?
So that's a question I've been thinking about a lot, because it's something that was discussed recently among friends. And I think that there's what I've seen from my interactions with people that I know is that because the like of the hegemonic nature of like neoliberal ideology and of the like weird capitalist party structure where there's never even the option. It's kind of just like the liberals or the conservatives, and there's no like sometimes arguing about things like healthcare reform being against it, not like because I don't think people should have healthcare, but because like health insurance is not care, first of all, like I, you know, all kinds of things. And people would just immediately kind of lash out about like, why don't you want people to have the thing? Like, I have diabetes and now I can have insurance. And I'm like, I can't afford my copays because I'm poor. So, but there's also people like in that framework that are left of liberal and just like haven't maybe done as much reading or haven't had a kind of like exposure to some radical ideas. And I think that like expecting people to come to anarchism and like on their own is counterproductive, and that when you look at the history of anarchism in the United States and when it was like at its most vibrant, possibly people were doing speaking tours and making newspaper headlines, and like not everyone wants to be in that position for sure, but the fact that there was that kind of visibility for these like alternative politics to the mainstream was, we don't have that now. We have to make our own media, and we do that, and that's still like not reaching out. And so if there's folks that are open to like hearing these ideas, you know, like a lot of times people want to know like, oh, when did you like really become a radical or whatever? So there's always that moment. It's not like, you know, you come out of the womb or whatever and you're like, fuck cops. I mean, maybe, but so I think there's room for engagement with people that are open to it. And I've had people, you know, respond positively to things that I've said, and that makes it kind of feel like worth engaging. But on the other hand, there's people that are gonna like keep insisting that if you hate fascism and you wanna like defend yourself and fight back and like take the initiative instead of just waiting, then you also are just as bad, because that's, I don't really understand why there's no, well, I guess they're, like Julie said earlier, there's no power analysis and assuming that all forms of violence are the same. And also that violence is only, like, a particular kind of violence. There's no look at structural violence, like the violence of not saying anything and letting, you know, being complicit in things is not discussed. So, yeah, it depends. basically. And also, if you don't have the energy for it, I don't think anyone needs to, like, put themselves on that horrible, horrible treadmill of arguing with somebody that's not down to listen.
Yeah.
I actually feel pretty excited for partnerships and collaborations and working together with a lot of different groups of people. I mean, I have no interest in creating space for just more hand-wringing. I mean, that's not even action, you know? So it's one thing to, like, go to a street protest and have people with signs and chanting things that don't represent your political position at all and maybe kind of the nature of liberal that you're talking about. And there's always going to be those people, and that's fine. I mean, I guess I prefer that they're at least out in the streets than the people who are like, well, I guess he's just the president. There's nothing we can do. so, but beyond that, as we actually get into the real mobilization against the policies that he's putting forward, you know, I think that there's going to be tactics that are very clearly marked by not necessarily that the people who are doing them are like card-carrying anarchists or whatever, but I think that there's like some hallmarks of what are considered like anarchist tactics of self-defense, community defense, autonomy, you know, direct action. So making sure that people in your community know how to do abortions or healthcare when those things aren't available, or if those like reproductive health is threatened, things like that. So just making sure that the skills are present in your community to meet the needs of your community, right? Like that feels very much like something that I associate with like an anarchist tendency. But then there's all these other things that we've kind of, at least in this session, been talking and kind of like implying a lot about, which is this more like generalized societal taking over by, you know, an authoritarian regime that could even potentially be fascist at some point. And that inherently goes, it does go beyond any particular tendency and really affects everyone, although some more so. And I think that what's going to be exciting is working with people and maybe stretching ourselves to set aside some of our knee-jerk reactions as anarchists. It'll be necessary. I mean, for instance, just to get like specific, like an example is this question about sanctuary cities. So you've seen across the country mayors of larger cities, LA, Chicago, New York, Seattle, coming out very strongly against this idea of secure communities, which is the program by which, you know, ICE collaborates with local level law enforcement to drive deportations and detentions for immigrants. So you see these mayors coming out against that and proclaiming that their cities, which are currently sanctuary cities, so cities that don't fall under the purview of that program or have resisted that program, will continue to resist that program, even under a more repressive and aggressive regime. And that's great that they're doing that. So, but one of the kind of arguments that they make whenever they talk about sanctuary cities is explicitly that the reason that those administrations support being sanctuary cities is because it allows law enforcement to build trust in the community. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, like one of the most popular arguments against having secure communities, is that it prevents law enforcement from being called, like, because people are scared that they're going to get ICE involved. So you often have people being like, you know, the police chief comes out and says, you know, we don't want people not to call us. We want people to call us. And if we have secure communities, then people won't call us. And so it is very likely that we'll be hearing that kind of argumentation as we go forward, and as people inevitably in Asheville and beyond call for more local level kinds of commitments to resisting collaboration with ICE. And as an anarchist, that obviously is not my priority to build trust within communities when it comes to collaboration. To law enforcement. But at the same time, you know, communities have self-determination. And if that's the line of argumentation that people
want to use because either they believe it or they just think it's the best way to get the policy they need in place to protect their communities. I think that we can have conversations as individuals and as fellow activists and things about whether we agree with that or not. But I don't think that, like, sitting around rolling our eyes at the rally is, like, a good idea. Like, if you don't want to hear that rhetoric, just sit that one out maybe and decide whether the larger goal of, like, preventing mass deportations is more important than, like, offending your anarchist sensibilities or whatnot. And also, I think that the critiques of things like law enforcement, that doesn't just exist in the anarchist community or doesn't just exist in, like, the non-immigrant anarchist community or whatnot. Like, there are plenty of critiques of law enforcement that come from within those communities, and it's way more productive of a conversation to have the critiques of law enforcement come from within the community and be like, hey, you know, actually, law enforcement is not that great. These are the ways that law enforcement hurt our communities. And we definitely don't want ICE involved, but we also don't want to make, you know, our communities like a haven for policing either. And those conversations will be more productive when they're coming from within those communities than, like, anarchists who are not necessarily as affected on the front lines of an issue like that are like, oh, well, I wanted to work with this, like, rad group until I heard them, like, talking about the police or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Depending on what the goal is, like, if there's a common goal, which is protecting people from deportation, like, yeah, the cops are going to be like, yeah, people should, if this happens, like, people should be, like, free to call us if there's an issue. But I don't see any reason why the work can't be happening, like, to both establish end a relationship with ICE and while at the same time, like, continuing to build alternatives to policing. And, like, if there's people in that group that are like, well, this is the group that's doing something, so this is why I'm here. Like, there's, I personally, just because of it's what I do for work, like, I will always recommend readings and post things. So there's really great critiques of, like, community policing, which is a big in favor a lot of places now, even, like, about how even that concept just expands the reach of law enforcement and, like, the scope of the criminal justice in air quotes system. So I think that being absent from those groups altogether means that people don't get to hear alternatives and don't get to hear a critique of their own, like, engagement. And that if you are in that situation and you decide that you, like, really cannot work with these people, that's totally, you know, like, someone's choice to make. But to stick to a really hard line, I guess it makes me wonder, like, if the what's important to you is, like, being, like, the best anarchist or, like, living by a code of morals and ethics that, like, matters to you. And I would rather, like, prevent people from being deported than, like, win anarchist points.
Yeah.
Ditto.
For sure.
Well said. And, like, the reality of an empowered, like, white supremacist, white nationalist base is that, like, it is – there's so many fronts. Like, every institution is open to – I mean, it already is. Like, that's the thing, is this is all on a continuum, right? Like, we already – we haven't been living in some golden age utopia up until the moment that Trump was elected, right? So so much of what we're seeing is only an intensification and a continuation of what's always been there.
That's such a good point.
And that, you know, that's just the way that that this country is. So I think we've developed a lot of strategies already that have been useful. I mean, most people, I think, who listen to the show probably know that under President Obama, you know, more people have been deported than under any other previous administration. So it would be quite shocking, frankly, if Trump is able to deport more people than Obama did. So this is on a continuum. And the reality of this, like, even more emboldened right is that, like, schools were already seeing awful things happening in schools. We're seeing, like, trans women attacked in parks, all kinds of horrible things. So it really does feel like people just need to, like, plug in where they are with who they can And that means like coworkers and people in just the people that you meet. And I don't believe in like only working with or talking to people who share your politics. And that will definitely not create any kind of like societal pushback to creeping fascism.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the pure anarchist line and the challenges ahead, I was maybe to expand on the question that was asked before. It's pretty telling to me how like many anarchists have been discussing like tactics and like calling for assemblies and having meetings and so forth. And it seems that, like, based on that tactically, a lot of people, like, within anarchism are on, like, pretty similar pages regarding, like, crisis mode or whatever. But that being said, is there anything, like, tactically or strategically that – are there things that aren't being discussed that you would like to see getting more play?
Well, in Asheville – I haven't heard, actually not just in Asheville. I think because Trump's rhetoric really focused super heavily on some specific groups that were like named, like Muslim folks and like undocumented folks, there's definitely been a lot of attention on how to provide like solidarity and support to those communities. Obviously, his anti-LGBT rhetoric has been so blatant that folks are definitely like gearing up to engage in self-defense and all different kinds of things. But this idea of him being kind of like the law and order candidate or president has kind of, not that it slipped under the radar, but it's like more amorphous, right? And it's like clearly coded, to me, it's clearly coded language that is like targeted toward like Black folks. And I think that the prospect of stop and frisk becoming a national policy and him like tapping like Rudolph Giuliani, who was the mayor of New York when there was a huge expansion of stop and frisk, is really, really concerning. And that hasn't, it's been harder, I think, for us to kind of like pin down what needs to be done to respond to that. And I think that kind of like goes back to the continuum thing of some just kind of mind-blowing nature of anti-Blackness in this country is such that it's always it's just like a constant feature of life. Like violence against Black bodies is just a constant feature of life in the United States, mm-hmm. and other places as well, but particularly in the United States. So it's like hard to point to the moment it got really bad and we needed to mobilize. I mean, there have certainly been points in history when like more concerted efforts have been prominent and in the public eye, but like that, I think, is another replay. I mean, again, like you see, you know, mayors of major cities talking about going toe-to-toe against the president of the country and like possibly like passing up like millions of dollars of federal funding in order to affirm the value of the lives of immigrants. And that is great and that is amazing and those lives are valuable. But like, where is the public affirmation of the value of Black lives? And that never had, like, that affirmation never comes. And part of the thing that allows it to never come is that our racially coded language is so deeply entrenched that, like, Trump doesn't have to say, is about to get seriously repressive and violent toward Black folks. It's just understood, mm-hmm. and it's just expressed in so many ways that, like, then there isn't this moment where people can be like, well, this is how we're going to engage with, like, mm-hmm. you know, a movement for Black lives. I mean, I guess that's, like, a quick way of saying it is, like, we need to perhaps be more concertedly, like, engaging with the movement for Black lives. Like, they won't name it, so we have to name it.
Yeah.
I think something else kind of, I think this relates to what Julie said and what you've said as well, is that there's this perception, like, yes, things are intensifying, and it's kind of like, oh, this is the nightmare world is, like, feels a little more real. But constantly being, like, having to defend and react rather than, like, taking initiative is something that, because, like, the, like, you know, deportations have been happening, and, like, violence against Black lives has been happening. And yes, there's definitely been actions taken, and then it kind of, like, I don't know, it dies down. And on the one hand, I do understand that we're all struggling. I wonder how to move to a more offensive rather than defensive position. Like, that's something I would like to discuss, because if things are, like, if things die down and whatever happens, like if Trump goes and then something, well, then I don't even want to get into the vice president. But if Trump goes and then, like, Hillary's magically, like, Hillary Clinton's magically president, like, are all the anarchists going to be like, ah, cool.
Phew.
I need, like, a nap. And it's like, I do need a nap, but also I don't want that, like, kind of, like, the fire that's been lit to go out.
We kind of already touched on the topic of the general strike, but I was wondering, May, if you had any words about, like, what you thought about the tactic of a general strike.
Yeah, I am so 1,000,000,000% for it. That number is not real, but neither is anything. And I think that what I really desperately want to see is that, like, I think that it's going to, strikes have been shown to be effective, and they're very dangerous, and that's why when people used to really go on strike back in the day, like, there were private guards hired, and, like, the National Guard was there, and people got killed, and that's scary, but people are already getting killed, so, like, what, you know, you can, like, take action and take a risk, or you could, like, do nothing, and you're still at risk, to be honest, if you're any kind of marginalized person. And so I really am excited about it, but I really hope that there can be some kind of effort to really talk to people about why the tactic is important, why it's effective, and to figure out how to kind of address the fear that prevents mass actions from occurring, which is that, you know, people sit to themselves and they're like, well, if, like, I go on strike, but no one else that I work with goes on strike, then I'm going to be, you know, like, I could lose my job. Like, I got to feed my kids. Lisa needs braces, you know.
Or I just feel silly.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the sucker.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, addressing that fear and figuring out a way, because, like, people participating at every level, like, from all kinds of demographics and stuff, is going to be really vital to its success. And that's not possible if there's, like, a lack of trust that people are going to have your back, or, yeah, like, figure out how to deal with this thing in a way that, like, doesn't bring more harm to folks that are already experiencing harm. But I'm really excited by the potential. I hope that it's less disappointing than Obama. It's hopes and dreams. Yeah.
May, can I ask you a follow-up question? And Adrian, you can answer this too. Oh my God. A day is night, up is down. Oh, the interviewee is to upend the pyramid.
Yeah.
Hierarchy for never. And, like, it's so great to hear someone, like, be so for the strike tactic, because I was totally, like, waning in my excitement because of all the things that you just mentioned, of just being like, no one else is going to do it, and they're not going to get it. And, like, so, I mean, that is really great to hear you be so excited about it, because it makes me re-excited about it. And I love the idea of having these conversations and strategizing ahead of time about how to make that case to people. I'm curious if you've given any thought to, people will probably ask, like, well, what's the demand? Like, usually in a strike, there's this idea of a demand that's trying to get met. And so I was just, like, wondering if y'all have ideas about that.
Just silently hand them a copy of We Don't Make Demands and then pull up my bandana and run away. No, just kidding. or, like, back away, like Homer Simpson into the bushes. No. I think that talking about the I do agree with the idea that, like, making demands does kind of presuppose that there's people that can grant your wishes, and that I would like to see, you know, like, just people mobilizing because they give a shit, and then seeing the, like, possibility of strength in numbers, which we, like, really don't have. We're all kind of atomized and alienated. Thanks, late capitalism. And so that's part of it, but I know that it is going to come up. So, right. So in terms of demands, I think that when talking about, I do want to be clear that getting rid of Trump is not the idea. Like, being like, we don't want Trump, we want Hillary. No, I mean, but if someone is gonna go on strike because that would be an outcome that would satisfy them, I'd just be like, all right, just come on out, and we can figure it out later. And then tell people that, like, maybe rather than having a demand for a strike, that this is, like, taking direct action. It is riskier than the f***ing safety pin, but, like, f***ing do it. And, like to show people that are scared for their families, their lives, their loved ones, their family integrity, whatever, that people, like, care enough to mobilize in some way. So, like, yeah, I would say that would be part of my response. Probably I'll have to think about it more, and that's a really good question to pose. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Cool. It was cool to be out of the interviewer chair for a second. But I did not even think about the possibility of a demand until you posed that question. But in the, like, 3 minutes that May was talking, I was like, my wheels were spinning a bit. And I think that, like, for me personally, like, if I am asked about demands, I probably will not really say much of anything except, like, it's not about demands. It's about, like, a refusal of the far right and a refusal of, you know, everything that has happened and everything that has been happening up until this point. Violence against, like, marginalized communities is not anything new. It is not a thing that's just started since, like, Tuesday the 8th or whatever date it was. Just like a refusal of the far right, a refusal of the alt right, employing a tactic that, like, I can employ, you know? That's about what I'd say, which, like, won't really satisfy all that many people, but maybe will satisfy me.
I'm, like, loving the word refusal right now. That word keeps, like, coming up for me a lot, just in my brain, like, total refusal. Yeah. I will say, like, in my thinking about it, I would also, like, say, actually, this isn't about demands, partially because, like, as May kind of showed, like, there isn't, even if we believed in making demands as a tactic, there's, like, no good demand for this because it's about electoral politics.
Sean Swain.
And now a word from Sean Swain. Yeah.
I just want to say his numbers have probably been getting suppressed and it's f***ed up.
Release the report. Yeah. But also because, like, how would we agree on a tactic? It would be impossible, and it would be besides the point. I feel like the message that I want to let people know about why a strike feels good is that it is a show of force, mm-hmm. like a show of potential force and power that people have. And the idea is to, for us all to know what kind of collective energy we can harness, mm-hmm. and to show that collective energy, because the day that has been floated for the strike is the day of the inauguration. So it's obviously not, like, a preemptive action to get him to, like, step down or something. That doesn't seem to be the framing of it. It really is a message, right? And so I like the idea of people finding out for themselves and showing to others on the day that he gets sworn into office that, like, this is what we can do. This is probably only a fraction of what we can do because we're not actually out here striking for any actual particular specific f***ed up thing. Mm-hmm. That, oh, wait, these are so many swear words. How are we going to put this on the radio?
No, it's cool. I'm going to censor y'all.
Thank goodness.
Sorry. You know now, an hour and 20 minutes into the interview, so.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Better yeah. late than never.
I am not voting for you ever.
Yeah, like if we can get this unruly and like get a bunch of people to skip work and like, you know, damage productivity, hopefully, and like profits for a day, just because you are like passing from the like amorphous gate from like citizen to like ruler. Imagine what we can do and what can we can shut down when you've actually done something messed up that we want to try to prevent or reverse. Yeah. So it's like it's practice and it's basically a warning in my mind.
For sure.
Yeah, and like not to get too academic about it, but like from the perspective of like something like social psychology, okay, there's a really good article a while ago about the psychology of school shootings and anti that, but and also school. They talked about protests and how there's someone that like if they saw a crowd that was doing something, they would be like motivated to join by the crowd. And then like the people that are in that crowd were maybe motivated by like people that were, I don't know, yelling or something effectively. And those people were motivated by like one person throwing a brick through a window. And so on the one hand, not that like to put too much emphasis on like the fact that there needs to be like one that's like the initiator of the movement or whatever, but but that like building critical mass is how to also challenge this perception that we are like a bunch of like a powerless electorate and that all our options are and crap. Like, I don't really want to pull one of those levers. I would rather have, you know, real food, and if I have to take it, then that. Yeah.
Or that, like, all we can do is symbolic action.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say this, too, that I think that it's important in terms of the strike to talk about how just people just staying home is definitely going to make a big difference, but also people taking their day off, hope the weather's nice, to maybe go outside for a walk, holding a sign, you know, something.
Maybe go on a road trip if that's what you want.
Yeah, yeah. DC is great. So many museums, which I hope will be closed. That's a thing. But there's all kinds of ways to participate. Also, I would like to mention that the call for the strike, or at least one call that I've seen, mentioned no housework, and just want to like put a shout out to like unpaid labor that also upholds the economy. So just leave the dishes in the sink. It's fine.
Do y'all have anything to add at all? I mean, I'm sure there's so many more directions this interview could have gone in and so many directions that it could potentially go. And we could probably talk about it for a really long time. But do y'all have any closing words or anything you wanted to add that like didn't get touched upon in this interview?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It was really nice to be here and to actually get to say these things and not just, like, type them furiously at 3 a.m. So, gratitude. And also, I don't know if you saw it, but you could put it up if you feel like it. But I wrote, if anyone is, like, having a time, particularly with the rhetoric of, like, of what violence is and is not like shamed or condoned. I made a very brief reading list
cool.
That I posted up. so if anyone needs those, it's like not nearly very comprehensive, but it's something.
We'll include it in the blog post.
I also appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and us.
May and Julie, thank you so much for coming on to the show. It's been always a pleasure, and it's awesome to be in community with y'all, and I feel really lucky to have y'all as comrades.
That was our conversation with May and Julie about anarchist strategy and current events and ways to get involved. I highly encourage people to check out our podcast version of this conversation, which is quite a bit longer. You can also find it via the finalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.